Hey, this is Gretchen Peters, and you're listening to the Neon Eon.
All right, I guess we're now 2 for 3 on getting folks to do the radio liner read. That's progress, y'all. Just as Gretchen said, you are dialed into the Neon Eon. I am your host, music journalist Thomas Mooney. This is episode number 3, where I am joined by Nashville Songwriters Hall of Famer, the Grammy-nominated and CMA Award winner, Gretchen Peters. Okay, so when I was initially conceptualizing what exactly I wanted the Neon Eon to be, like anything, it went through a few different ideas before I honed in on this one. The framework was always based on a few, in my opinion, strong pillars. One, the obvious, a focus on country music from this specific era. And two, to use this as a vehicle to talk about great songs and stories. And connected to that, great, but often forgotten and or underrated songwriters of that day. During this, I've always wanted to speak with and about the superstar artists. That should be a given, but I also thought it was paramount to speak with those whose names may be a little bit lesser known because they're typically in smaller print underneath the song title in those liner notes and not on that front cover. Like a lot of the songwriters of this era who had these massive cuts by superstar artists, Gretchen, she always viewed herself as a singer-songwriter and not just as quote-unquote songwriter. So while you will definitely know songs by Gretchen, such as Let That Pony Run by Pam Tillis, On a Bus to St. Cloud by Trisha Yearwood, Independence Day, and My Baby Loves Me by Martina McBride, You Don't Even Know Who I Am by Patti Loveless, and The Secret of Life by Faith Hill, and so many more, it's also a great idea to check out her own solo material. In particular, her 1996 debut, The Secret of Life, it falls right in line with some of those other great storyteller albums of the day, like Your Love and Other Lies by Buddy Miller, Wrapped by Bruce Robinson, The Last of the True Believers by Nancy Griffith, Diamonds and Dirt by Rodney Crowell, or like Come On, Come On by Mary Chapin Carpenter. And yes, I know, those last two, those were massive chart toppers, but I don't care. That's not the point. The point is that those records are incredibly great albums filled with these great songs, and that while they are critically acclaimed, they may not be known to the masses as well. So yeah, The Secret of Life by Gretchen, I would put it on par with any of the records that I just listed, and it is definitely in that upper echelon of underrated albums, the criminally underrated albums of that era. All right, I'll make this next part go as quickly as possible. Go subscribe to the Neon Eon wherever you listen to podcasts, iTunes, Spotify, etc. If you are on iTunes, go give the show a 5-star review. Tell us who you think needs to make an appearance on the Neon Eon. Go follow the Neon Eon over on all the social media stuff. We're over at the Neon Eon on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Be sure to check out the Patreon as well. It's a great way to support this podcast and become a bigger part of the conversation. And of course, it gets you some great perks like ad-free episodes, bonus content, and yes, Neon Eon merch, which, yeah, hopefully I'll have the online merch store up and running really, really soon. The part that they don't tell you about in journalism school is how, yeah, it's great to be proficient as a writer, but you should also be proficient in design and e-commerce and manufacturing and, yeah, another story for a different day. But speaking of stories, two more things. One, if this is your first time listening to the Neon Eon, go back and listen to episode 1 with Clay Walker and 2 with Pam Tillis. 2, as I mentioned up top, I'm a music journalist and writer. So for more podcasts and the written word, you can go follow me on Twitter at _newslang. That is the title of my other podcast that's focused on Americana and other country music. So yeah, subscribe to that as well. All the links, they'll be in the show notes. All right, let's do it. Here is Gretchen Peters. I guess like where I want to start out with is, you know, you moved to Nashville in the late 80s and you obviously had been playing music beforehand and everything, but what was it like, I guess, moving to, you know, this bubble, this hub of music and trying to, you know, for lack of a better term, like break in and like start meeting people and all of that stuff. What was that like as far as like being introduced to that music scene and that songwriter scene?
Oh, there's so many layers to that. Because, you know, for one thing, I had spent years reading the backs of album covers, and, you know, I knew who the songwriters were, and I was intimidated and in awe. I think that's pretty common to come to town and feel simultaneously intimidated and awed, but also have a certain kind of fire lit in you. Like I remember a lot of the time thinking, oh God, I should just pack it up and go back to Colorado. And then the next, you know, there would be another moment, you know, sometimes like in the same 5 minute span when I would think, I think I can do this. You know, I would just vacillate between those two extremes, because the music was so inspiring, but I also had enough of a sense of myself to know that I didn't know what I was doing yet. So there was that feeling. Also, a lot of the way Nashville worked was really foreign to me, and I didn't really quite understand it or grasp it. I felt like there was this very strong line of delineation between singers and songwriters, and that didn't make any sense to me as somebody that came from, you know, from a lifetime of listening to singer songwriters and kind of modeling myself after them. And I'm talking, you know, everybody from Joni Mitchell and Paul Simon to people like Rodney Crowell. You know, some of my heroes after I discovered country music, Mickey Newberry. To me, it was confusing to be asked, what do you want to be, a singer or a songwriter? Because those are two different paths. And I think the only thing that I really understood deeply was I wanted, my ultimate goal was to be a singer songwriter. I wanted to do it all. I wanted to write, record, tour, all of that. And the only thing that I knew in my bones, I think, at the time when I got here, was that if I were going to be able to convince a record company that would sign me to record my own songs, I would have to prove myself as a writer. So I just sort of put that goal in front of me and went for that. I never envisioned coming to Nashville and being a hit songwriter. You know, I mean, that wasn't even something that was a goal of mine. I'm grateful for it, very grateful for it, but it wasn't my primary goal. It was just the songwriting, you know, looking for a publishing deal when I first came to town was just a matter of trying to prove that I could write so that I could get on with my own career. So in some ways I found it baffling and bewildering. But I was ambitious and I was young and I was also just so thrilled to be in the company of these people who I had, you know, whose music I had lived with and loved for years. It was a heady time. It was frustrating and exciting and thrilling. And you also kind of had this feeling. I came here in late 87. You also had this kind of feeling like something was happening, like things were changing. The music was changing. For someone like me who grew up with folk music, there was this thread of sort of folkiness, you know, entering into country music because, you know, it was, I think, partly a generational thing. And that excited me because I felt like it made me feel like there was maybe a place for me here, whereas there might not have been earlier on. I don't know. I mean, I grew up in New York, so I knew I was never going to be, you know, I was never going to be Loretta Lynn. You know, I didn't have those stories to tell, but I had stories. And it seemed like in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a place for a lot of different kinds of stories. And that was pretty exciting. There was a limitless feeling to it. And those were really good years because great songs, you know, there was the old adage, if you know, a good song may or may not get through, but a great song always will. And we all really believed that. And it really seemed like it was true.
Yeah, like it seems like, you know, from an outside perspective, looking back, A, it feels like this really interesting time between, as you mentioned, like there's the, for lack of a better term, like these two camps, like you're either an artist or a songwriter. And so it's like that establishment, but it feels like at this time there was this, a lot of these older songwriters who had been around and in town for a long time and had been writing songs and writing these hits. And then this like wave of these newer artists, these newer songwriters coming in who, as you mentioned, you know, you're from New York. You're not the same background as a Loretta Lynn, but you have like, there was a lot of y'all who came in at this time and, added all these stories, and it's this interesting mix, I feel, that, and that's what kind of makes this era interesting as far as like the output of songs.
I think that's right. I mean, I think we weren't, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, I look back and I think we didn't have this overlying concern of, I mean, I don't think anybody even used the word branding at that point ever. I don't think I ever heard that word. And there wasn't this sense like I feel like there is now, where country music is sort of, it's almost like a lifestyle brand. For us, I think country music meant honest, authentic, heartfelt stories. And you could be Merle Haggard and tell those kind of stories. You could be Steve Earle, or you could be Nancy Griffith. It didn't really matter. It all sort of fell under that umbrella, and it all came down to songs. And I think that was the thing that was so great about that time, is we weren't, you know, I was lumped in a lot with Mary Chapin Carpenter, who had a very similar upbringing to me, actually. And she was a country artist. So I think we weren't hemmed in so much by the look and the branding and the whole, you know, is it country or what is it? There seemed to be this freedom. I think the freedom really boils down to a lot of the time, the freedom, artistic freedom, the lack of awareness that there is so much money to be made. I mean, this is pre-Garth Brooks. This is pre-most artists selling maybe more than a million albums. And even that was, you know, remarkable. I mean, we didn't have too many multi-platinum artists. Once people started cotton on to the fact that there was a lot of money to be made in the mid-90s, I would say, in country music, Shania Twain, Garth Brooks, that sort of thing. That's when the focus groups came in, and that's when the branding and all that started, because everybody, it's human nature to want to corral that and reproduce it and figure out what makes it happen and what doesn't make it happen. But that hurts the art. It always hurts the art.
Yeah. Like that's one of those things that I want people to get out of this too, is the understanding that, you know, before the 90s, like country, of course, it was popular, but it's not popular in the way it is now, as far as being part of the mainstream and having these artists who really just broke out. You know, you mentioned Garth and Shania, like they, and just like the introduction of the CD, that really popularized country music and made it, you know, just go full mainstream.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that slant. But yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, I think Garth Brooks, and Garth, don't get me wrong, I mean, Garth Brooks has cut some of the best songs that were written at the time. Mm-hmm. And really had, he really had an ear for a great song. But because of his popularity, there were a lot of people, I think, that just thought, that's cool, I want to be like that. And there wasn't a whole lot much more thought to it than that. And I think those of us that were dyed in the wool, like me, for instance, I mean, I discovered country music kind of backwards, through the back door, through the Gram Parsons door, you know, but came to love George Jones and Merle Haggard. And, you know, I know a lot about country music because I was a student of it for a long time. Those of us that came at it that way, you know, I don't think for us it was ever, it was ever because the image was particularly cool. It was because the songs and the music was so great. And I mean, there's a whole, I could spend an hour talking about why I love country music and why I gravitated towards it, not having grown up on it. But I think there was a real difference. And I think we, again, it just goes back to the songs. I think there was a feeling on Music Row among publishers, writers, and A&R people, record labels too, that the song was the thing. It just always came right back to that. And to me, that was like, that was the one constant you could hang your hat on. The one thing that you could always go back to the drawing board and try to write a better song. And if you did, you could have some faith that it would take you somewhere. And I'm sad to say, I don't really believe that's true anymore.
Yeah. Like there's a lot that you said there. Like for starters, you mentioned Garth, early Garth, like he is cutting some amazing songs. And I think like people don't understand that too. Before this, and I think like true country, there's this intimacy that just kind of makes where I guess like the best moments in country is small rooms. And, you know, once it becomes super mainstream and it becomes, you know, where these shows are in these massive arenas, you lose a little bit of that magic and there's like that, I guess that break between listening to a song and wanting to be entertained. And
yes,
it's and all they're connected. I don't know. It's
well, and you know, the that kind of the rub or the struggle between the impulse to entertain and the impulse to make art is present. It's present everywhere all the time in any kind of, you know, any kind of art form that's monetized. I mean, anywhere. It's just that when with the introduction of a lot of money, huge amounts of money, artists selling, you know, multi-platinum, 5, 6, 7 platinum record, then it becomes really emphasized and it really becomes it becomes a thing that impedes art from happening. In other words, to be completely practical about it, or to be more specific, it keeps a record label, say, from signing an artist that they know is never going to sell multi-platinum, but that might have a long and even historic career, because there's no time to nurture an artist like that, because they got to find the next million multi-million selling artist. Whereas if there's not that pressure, there's room to sign artists that need development, you know, that might not really come to full flower until their third or fourth album. And that kind of goes out the window when you introduce huge amounts of money into the equation. And there's a lot more layers to that too. I mean, it has to do with, you know, as in the first 10 years that I was in Nashville, we saw the corporatization of Music Row. I went from my first publishing deal I signed in 1988 at the beginning of the year. I'd been here 3 months, and I went from this tiny little publishing company that was owned by the Oak Ridge Boys. We were bought by one company, and then we were bought by Lorimar, and then we were bought by Warner Chappell in the space of 3 years. And I signed it at a little, well, it was a bigger company, but it was still an independent company called Tree in 1990. That was my second publishing deal. And within the first year of that deal, they were bought by Sony. So I ended up on Sony, you know, being published by Sony Music. So that sort of thing was just happening all through that period of time. And we started out in these little tiny publishing houses with 5 writers and ended up with 65 writers or 105 or, you know, something like that. And it just, that went hand in hand with the growth of country music. And that made it also harder to get the individual attention. And there was also, there became this feeling at some point, I think, of disposability about the songs. Like, what have you written last week? What's your, yeah, we pitched that song 2 months ago, but that's old. What have you got now? That sort of thing kind of crept in too.
Yeah. Like trying to, I guess like the pressures of meeting a certain quota that is like just kind of on it. Like, I don't know, maybe a little too far-fetched for art, you know, is that what you're saying? Like,
well, I mean, for a writer like me, I mean, one of the things that I was strongly encouraged to do when I moved to town was to co-write, because for no reason, I don't really think there was any other reason other than that's what everybody was doing. I mean, I've still to this day, I can't imagine why a publisher would encourage me to split my song in half and give them half of the, only half of the royalties when I could have written it myself. I mean, I was lucky to have a publisher, my first publisher, who said, look, I see you struggling with co-writing. You clearly are not cut out for it. I really like having 100% of your copyright. Why don't you just write by yourself, And I was so lucky to have someone in a kind of mentoring position to me then who gave me permission not to co-write. And that really enabled me to just do my own thing. And I would never have written Independence Day or a lot of the other songs that I've written had I not had the sort of permission to write by myself and write what I really wanted to write. But the problem is, for a writer like me who writes primarily alone, I never had a particularly high output. I mean, I knew people that were writing a couple hundred songs a year, and I wrote maybe 15 a year, but I wrote them all by myself. And I also had a pretty high batting average. I mean, I had a, they were all up to a certain level of quality. They weren't all great, but they were all, I think because I wrote by myself and I took my time, I think I threw out a lot of the sort of stuff that other writers who co-wrote may have just turned into their publisher. I don't know how you write 200 songs a year. I just don't understand how it's done. I'm not that sort of writer. So I guess what I'm saying is, for someone like me, I needed a publisher who was willing to have patience with me and take my time, knowing that I would turn in something good, but also knowing that they weren't going to get this avalanche of songs from me that they could run with. So they'd better take the good ones and really, believe in them and pitch them. And I was lucky enough to have, in both of my publishing deals, that sort of a publisher. But I was a kind of an anomaly as a writer, because, most people were co-writing at least with one other writer, and sometimes, three. And that was more the norm. And there were people like me and Hugh Prestwood and Tony Arata who pretty much wrote by ourselves, and Jamie O'Hara too.
Yeah. Like that's, I get like some of the co-writing stuff. Like it's, you get someone else in the room with you, maybe it brings something out of a song. But, in your situation, like, going through your catalog, going through all the songs that have been cut by you, having that high batting average, as you say, it feels like, most of these songs, you can hear you singing it. Like, and I feel like if you wrote 200 songs, there's no way you would feel that way about each one of them.
Well, that's right, because I don't have that much to say. I mean, I think the thing is, I have a couple of co-writing relationships that have, gone on, one of them for over 20 years, but I can hear the difference in those songs, and I'm adequate. I'm good at what I do when I'm in that situation, but I'm really at my best. There's no question in my mind that I'm at my best by myself. I write my best songs that way. And it is because there's a voice there, and I think that's the thing. They're really almost two different forms of writing, I think, co-writing and writing solo. to me, they really feel like two different processes completely. And I was always just more comfortable and more motivated to write by myself, because I when I do get a song idea that I really believe in, I'm it's like an itch that I can't scratch enough, you know, and having somebody else in the room is really just almost a distraction to me.
How much of that has to do with like just the restraints of time, where if it is a co-write, you know, maybe there's pressure to write something within that afternoon or something, versus when you're writing by yourself, you can take time. And if it takes, you know, weeks or a year or something, even, you know, something a long time, a longer period of time, is that part of it too?
Oh, there was undoubtedly a lot of pressure that you would just feel in a co-writing situation. Everybody pretty much expected to write a song that afternoon or that morning. I mean, a lot of people would have two writing appointments a day, one at 10 and one at 2. Maybe they would continue the morning one, you know, with the same and work on the same song. But there was an unspoken, you know, we're going to get this thing finished today. And I can't even operate that way, because I have to put a song away and leave it alone and come back to it to even know how I feel about it. I mean, I can't even make a kind of assessment of what I've done the same day that I've done it. I do that with my own songs. I put them away for weeks sometimes and then bring them back out and try to listen to them with new ears. So that whole process was just fraught for me, because I was unable to conceive of writing a song in a morning. I mean, I can count on one hand the songs I've written by myself in a day, and I can still have a few fingers left over. So yeah, that was part of the deal. And what I did to try and stay productive, and also because it just worked for me, was I would always try to have a pile of songs that I was working on all at the same time. I mean, I would have a rotating pile of things that were just in some state of completion, but not there yet. And I would just always, you know, I'd go in my room and work on them. Whatever song sang to me that morning, or whatever, you know, I felt like I could make progress on, however I was feeling. And that way, at least I was always making some kind of progress somewhere. But the whole process was so different, because I didn't go into a cubicle like a lot of people, you know, went into writing rooms at their publishers or, you know, studios or whatever. And I stayed home and sat on my bed with my guitar. That's where I wrote. So the whole thing was just different. And I will say that one of the unintended effects of that for me was that I felt probably more isolated from the songwriting community than I might have had I been a frequent co-writer. It took me a long time to make some of the deep friendships that I've made with other writers, because I wasn't co-writing with them. It was basically for lack of opportunity. You know, I would see people at functions and things, but it wasn't like I was sitting in a room with them grinding out songs. And so years later, when I was inducted into the Nashville Songwriters Hall of Fame, part of my acceptance speech was, you know, I'm astonished that I'm sitting in a room with all of you who are my peers, and a lot of whom I said, I'm sorry, but I can't write with you because I'm a terrible co-writer. And here you all are, and you voted me in, you know, because I didn't have that, you know, I wasn't in the trenches in that same way with my peers. And so there was a bit of isolation about that. And I wouldn't have it any other way. I wouldn't have done it any other way, but I will say that I really treasure my friendships with my songwriting peers now, looking back, because my process for songwriting, what I did was fairly isolated and lonely a lot of the time.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned, you know, how at this time, like the focus was on the songs and the stories. And, you know, I've always been kind of infatuated with 90s country. And, you know, I guess it was like this past year where making like song lists of songs that were coming out of this era, I guess like one of the things that I noticed or felt whenever I looked at all of them kind of together was that a lot of these songs are about adult situations. And there's a lot of that that's lost today. We don't necessarily have to go down that road, but at this time, there's a lot of songs that I feel are about adult situations, about, you know, divorce or like child custody or, you know, difficult conversations, death and life. And you do such a great job of tapping into those difficult subjects. And, you know, obviously, like, let's go to Independence Day. There, that song right there is very, it's a serious song. It's about domestic abuse and stuff like that. And, you know, it's one thing, I guess, to get a song like that cut. I'm sure like you realized like at the time it was like, oh, well, this is a great song and you're excited to have it cut. But I guess like, were you surprised that it was released as a single and that it has had such a, you know, such longevity as a song, even though it has kind of been misinterpreted by every county fair?
I cannot overstate how shocked I am at what happened with Independence Day. I really believed, when I got done writing it, that I had an inkling. I'm never sure. I'm not the kind of person that bursts out of the room and says, I just wrote a great song. You know, I don't, I've never had that level of confidence and certainty about it, but I do have an inkling sometimes. And I've learned, you know, over the years, if I have an inkling, I probably am on to something, you know. So I did have an inkling that that was a great song. But having said that, I also had a high level of certainty that it would never be recorded because it was dark. It didn't have a happy ending. It, you know, there was so much wrong with it in terms of the, you know, the common, you know, the common knowledge about what makes a hit single. I mean, the only thing it had going for it was up tempo, really, honestly, that there wasn't really much else about it. And I was equally shocked when I learned, when my publisher told me that Martina McBride had cut it. She was passionate about it. She absolutely wanted it on her album. You know, I couldn't have been more surprised. And then to see what happened with it. And especially with that song, because it really ran into a lot of resistance at radio. And it just seemed like there was such a strong gut response from listeners that they were the ones that really made it happen. They were the ones that called the radio stations and said, play this song again, you know, and we kind of overcame the hurdles of although it was, there were, I don't know, there were five or six of the top country stations that prevented it from ever going into the top five or 10 or something, because they wouldn't play it. Nevertheless, you can see what happened. I mean, I think it was a great lesson to me that chart position doesn't really mean anything. You know, it's how a song lives and resides in people's, you know, hearts and in their memories and in their gut that really determines whether a song means anything to anybody 20 years down the road, you know? So everything about that song was a surprise. But in terms of what you said about writing adult songs, I really want to address that because I think it's so important. And I think that was the reason I was drawn to country music at 18, 19 years old was, oh my God, there's this whole wealth of stories to tell that aren't about puppy love. You know, there's this whole universe of people and stories and life. And I was completely fascinated with the lyrics to country music songs. You know, for one of my very first loves was Merle Haggard. Merle Haggard to me was John Steinbeck, who's I had read every John Steinbeck book, I think, by the time I was 18. And to me, he was a musical John Steinbeck. Those were his stories, and those were the people and the characters in those stories. And I loved the idea. I think I was an old soul even then, because I loved writing about 35, 40 year old women when I was 18, you know, because I found them far more interesting, as characters than, you know, 18 year olds. So I think that was what drew me to country music, was the adultness of it. And I think that's what I bemoan the most about what we've lost. Although, you know, it's debatable to say we've lost it. I think that the great country songs are just now called Americana, really. You know, I don't think we've really lost that. I think they've just moved to another genre. But it was the adultness of country music that, for in a large part, is why I was so attracted to it. I mean, the wealth of stories that we could tell.
Yeah, I love that Steinbeck Merle Haggard comparison. I think that's just incredible. That's just great. Yeah, like there is still great songs being written, obviously, clearly. They are kind of in that Americano range, and you know, every once in a while they'll poke through onto radio, but you know, you mentioned like how Independence Day didn't go, you know, top five. I think just off the, through my notes here, I think it charted at number 11.
I think that's right.
That's what's so interesting and so strange, is like how it feels like it's both was embraced at the time, but also like very, you know, people were wanting to keep it at a distance, but you know, that longevity goes to, you know, it resonating with people at the time. And it just kind of, you know, people, if you look on like online, or if you have any conversations and about songs, like sometimes that song will be brought up about how they just love the storytelling, even though it is very heartbreaking. And there's something just real and honest and sincere about like the song and the story at its core.
Yeah, I think, and I think it's gone, you know, enough time has gone by that there's a whole, I mean, I'm really moved by a younger generation of people that, you know, were kids when that song came out, and kind of maybe they saw the video and they sort of got the gist of the story, but really more, it was more like part of the background of their lives, just the soundtrack. And then they've sort of rediscovered the lyric and gone, oh, this is pretty dark. You know, there's more to this than I really realized. I love that. I mean, there was an essay that was written by a young man in his, I guess in his 30s now, about Independence Day, and he rejected it when he was a kid because he rejected it as part and parcel of, you know, he was growing up gay in the South, and you know, this was just part of the oppressive culture that he was growing up in. And then he chanced to hear it out of context, I guess, one day as an adult, and realized, oh my God, I had this song all wrong, you know. And he really listened to the lyric, and he ended up writing this beautiful essay about it. I love to see things like that happen, because that's what art ought to do. It ought to stimulate conversations like that. I think it's a really rare thing. You don't get very many chances, if any, to have a song permeate the culture the way that one did for such a long time. I mean, I think you talk about chart position. Look up Gentle on My Mind sometime. I don't think that even went into the top 20. And yet that song is so much more memorable to so many people than, you know, all the other songs of that year, probably. So chart position is pretty, it's fun to have a number one record, but basically it's good for the party and that's about it. It doesn't really matter. I mean, 6 weeks later, no one remembers what went number one. I've had Independence Day called a number one hit, a Grammy winning hit, none of which it was. And it doesn't matter to people. What matters is where it lives in their heart. You know, that's really it.
Yeah, like it's great for the bio and the all that kind of stuff, but you know, like it's one of those things where.
Well, I never argue with them when they say Grammy winning. I just let them go on believing that.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up that, you know, the episode right before this, I spoke with Pam Tillis, and obviously she cut Let That Pony Run. And I'm going to paraphrase here what she was talking about, how there was a few times in her career where, you know, she heard a song and she just knew that she had to cut that song. And it was something that just resonated with her. And she mentioned how that was Let That Pony Run and how she just had to have that song. Do you remember, like, what's the story behind, I guess, you know, writing that song and then eventually getting it into someone's hands like Pam Tillis?
Well, my mother called me one day. She had a cousin who was about the same age as her. So this would have been, they would have been in their mid-60s maybe, or yeah, mid-60s, something like that. And her cousin had told her that her husband was divorcing her. And they'd been married for 40 years, I think. At least 40 years. And I hung up I was shocked because this was a person that, you know, had the perfect life. You never, never would have seen this coming. And I hung up the phone and I just had all these thoughts and all these feelings about it. Like, for one of the things I remember thinking is, after 40 years of marriage, why bother? I mean, why are you, you know, why upend your life like this? But I really thought of it in terms of my own mom, who had gone through a divorce much younger, but I had seen it up close and I had seen, you know, the trauma that she went through, because my mother's divorce was, you know, not her idea. It was not her wish. And this cousin of hers was going through the same thing, only at 65 years old or something. And I just thought, I thought about that a lot and I thought, what do you do? You know, what would it be like to be 40 years into a marriage and realize that it was all just a big lie, or at least it has been for the, you know, the past many years. I think her husband had told her he'd been having an affair with someone for 10 or 15 years. I mean, it was just the most appalling, horrible, awful situation. And that's where the song came from. That and the fact that I had written down in my notebook just one word, I'd written down the word pony. Sometimes words just have a certain kind of an appeal to me, and there's something about them, and I can't tell you what it is, or whether it's the sound or some kind of meaning or something. It's just something I'm feeling. But I had written this word pony down, and that was when I sort of put those two things together, and I thought, you know, she's just going to have to let that pony run, you know, and that was the song. And as far as Pam's involvement, I didn't know Pam really well, but I'd seen her here and there at she was also a writer at Sony Tree where I was, and Paul Worley, who was my publisher there, was her producer. So it was natural that he would play my songs for artists that he was producing, like Martina, like Pam, first, and give them kind of first crack at it. And Pam had just come out of the box with, I'm pretty sure, her very first single, which went straight to number one. It was a Harlan Howard song. It was a great song. And so Pam was hot. You know, she just had a number one single. And I heard that she had recorded that song, and I thought, as I always do, my main reaction to that is gratitude and and happiness. I've never felt, I get asked a lot of times, do you wish you'd saved this or that song for yourself? You know, and I just don't understand that. I've never felt that way. I've always felt like, God, you know, some other artist felt enough, was moved enough by a song I wrote to want to sing it every night. That's a huge compliment. You know, I've been on the other side, you know, I've been on the other side of, you know, choosing songs that I didn't write to record, and you damn well better love them because you may have to sing them every night. So, I've never felt anything other than gratitude about that. But Pam's a great artist. She's a great singer. She totally got the song. It was obvious when you heard the record that she got it in a big way. And I think it was something for her that, again, going back to the thing of adult material, you know, that's a very adult song. That's a thing that happens to grown-up people. And it's got all kinds of layers of complexity, and that was something that she was mature enough to want to sing about.
Yeah. I love, like, the, you know, just the imagery, of that song so much. And, like in that second verse, you talk about, you know, she got a divorce and a chestnut horse, and, you know, she's riding down by the river and, you know, feeling reckless, and she's feeling young, and she's like holding on tight and just like closing her eyes. And I just love all of that imagery about kind of, you know, after, as you say, after like the shock wears off.
Yeah. Well, you know,
I
think that I got so much of that second verse from watching my mom bloom after she got over the divorce from my father. I mean, my mother just blossomed into this whole other person with a life that she never could have imagined. She moved us to Colorado and she had all these new friends and she kind of became almost a hippie and, you know, just went through all these changes. And it was because of that divorce. And she went through hell when she was going through it, but it led her to this beautiful new life and new place, and new level of confidence in herself. So I'm sure that I was really writing about her in that second verse, because I do remember thinking when she told me about her cousin, you know, she's going to go through a hard time, but all kinds of great things are going to happen that she doesn't even know yet. I remember very distinctly thinking that. And that's because of watching my mom. She was a great role model for how to turn it all around and plow through it and kind of let go and let the universe show you where you're supposed to be. She was really a role model for that.
Yeah, definitely. So like, it's, you know, as my parents got divorced pretty early on, and I very much see that same thing. I guess is what I'm trying to say about, you know, my mother and even my grandparents, when they got divorced, my grandmother really had like this newfound independence at a later age than it's been. Obviously, I was little at the time, but like, you know, looking back, you kind of realize like these points, they all make sense because of that one bad thing that happened that they got out of, you know.
Well, yeah, those, and you know, I think I have this theory. I think as you go through life, you kind of either expand or you contract, you know. And if you contract, into bitterness and you fixate on things that happened in the past and you can't let them go and you can't move forward because you can't let go. Or you can expand, and the things that expand you and make you grow and really make you more empathetic, wiser, all the good things are the things that are the most painful. That's just life. That's just how that works. And so I think a lot of my subject matter in terms of writing kind of revolves around that. I'm fascinated with people that are in really difficult situations and what they do and how they, you know, do they get by because they're stoic? Do they fight back? You know, do they, are they angry? Are they resigned? Are they bitter? Do they have regrets? But what, you know, how do they get out of these situations? That's just fascinated me my whole life. And I think that, just observing people around me, like my mom, bloom and expand in the second part of her life was real inspiration for me and for that song too. And for a lot of my characters, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely. What about now this is one of my favorite George Strait songs, The Chill of an Early Fall. What about that kind of character where it's kind of right at the cusp of a breakup versus, you know, the aftermath?
Well, I have to preempt, or I have to issue a caveat on that song. The idea for that song I wrote, co-wrote with my ex-husband, Green Daniel. And the idea for the song was his. So he got totally just stuck in the middle of writing that, just at a place where he couldn't find his way out of the paper bag, so to speak. And I sort of acted as a midwife, I guess, on that song's birth. I mean, I came to it after he had the idea and had a lot of, you know, parts of the melody written and so forth, and parts of the lyric. And I looked at it and I recognized that it was a beautiful. There was a lot of beautiful imagery in that, and just really liked it. And I sort of untangled, I feel like I untangled that song more than writing it. So to me, I listen to that song now and I'm proud of it, but it doesn't have as much of my voice in it, I guess, as some of my later songs. Like Let That Pony Run, really, for me, was a turning point, because that was the first song that I had recorded that I felt like, oh, that's me out there. That lyric, that's me. It's maybe the first success that I had that felt like it had a lot of my identity attached to it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And the earlier hits, the ones before that, there was the George Strait, there was a Randy Travis, song called High Lonesome. There was a Highway 101 single that I had. They feel a little bit less personal to me, I guess, for that reason.
Yeah. Do you think that also that maybe the perception of you, the outside looking in on you changed with that song as well? Did you feel a change the way not just your peers, but maybe other artists and other
definitely. Yeah, I mean, when Let That Pony Run came out, I started, you know, people like Patti Loveless and Trisha Yearwood, Martina, people like that started asking for my songs, for one thing, because they had a point of view. They came from a certain point of view, and they wanted to say those, you know, those things. They were attracted to that point of view. And I think with A&R people and record people, they were asking for my songs for the same reason. Sometimes they couch it in kind of icky language, like we need a strong female, you know, up tempo, whatever. I don't know. There's shorthand for all of this stuff. I guess by necessity, but it always kind of grossed me out. but yes, I definitely noticed that I had some kind of an identity as a songwriter from that point on because of that song. They would come to me for certain kinds of songs. And of course, after Independence Day, they would come to me for another Independence Day, which I'm here to tell you ain't going to happen. You know, but because that's not how that works. But it definitely sort of set me up as someone with an identity as a writer. And I think also because I wrote it alone. I wrote all of those songs alone, with the exception of the George Strait thing. You know, I think it's easier to, it's certainly easier to pinpoint a voice, a writer's voice, when there's only one writer. You know, when things are co-written by two or three people, you're not, you know, unless you hear a lot of songs by those two or three people, you don't really know who's doing what, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Like there's that, the singular vision, obviously. And, you know, you can, that has to be part of it as far as there's nothing that feels out of place there or like a compromise between people. Yeah, that you can, that you'd maybe hear in something, you know, every once in a while there's songs like that where you hear that you go, well, I don't know where that, why that's in there. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. And Independence Day is a really great example of the whole compromise issue, because even I internalized this feeling that you shouldn't end a song so darkly. It should, you know, I mean, I struggled with that song for months and months and months, trying to end it in a more happy fashion. And because I had internalized that whole idea, you know, that it was too dark, nobody would accept a song that ended like this. And thank God in the end, I just kind of threw up my hands and go, you know, this, I just said, this is the story. This is this particular story, and this is how it ends. And that's all there is to it. And I turned it in that way, and I decided that I was going to stand by it. Because I think, you know, thank God there was enough of an artist's instinct in me to know that this was the right way to write this song. But the pressure from the outside, you know, when you're operating in this business and you're trying to, you know, you're trying to have some success, you don't want to create in a vacuum, the pressure is pretty intense, you know, to try and conform. But over and over again, I've found, and this is true, especially maybe more than anywhere in the 90s era of country music, the songs that really stick out to you, that still today that you remember, they all broke the rules in one way or another. I mean, Independence Day broke the rule. Strawberry Wine, written by my dear friend Matresa Berg, that broke every rule. It was a 5-minute waltz. There's no way that was supposed to get on the radio. You know, songs like one song that blew me away back then was Walk Away Joe, Trisha Yearwood. That's the songs that really, really, really stood the test of time. Almost every single one of them, in one way or another, broke the rules. And that's something to really take to heart, I think, for young songwriters. When I teach, I really try, if I can do nothing other than to encourage my students to listen to their own voice and strengthen their own instincts and strengthen that, you know, get that voice that's internal in them a little bit louder than all the voices around them telling them how to write and what to write about and what to say, then I feel like I've done my job, because the writer's gut instinct is really the only thing she is going to have going forward through life. And thank God I listened to my instincts on that one, because I really tried hard to make it more palatable, which would have, of course, ruined it.
Yeah, like that's really interesting, because, you know, and this all goes back to kind of saying how all these songs, you can hear you singing them, or I can envision, even if you didn't necessarily cut a song, or record a song that you wrote, you can hear you singing them, and, you know, think, even, I guess, I can see like where maybe this answer is going to be going, but like, you can't necessarily just be thinking about who's going to cut this song, or like who could cut this song. Does that even come into play?
I can't think about that. I don't think about it. Even back in the day, I didn't. I might think about it after the fact, but I'm usually wrong. And I think early on, I abandoned the idea that I had any talent at that end of things, and that thank goodness there were things like music publishers whose job it was to figure out where these songs go. And I sort of took a pretty fatalistic approach to it. Like, they're going to go where they go. They're like kids, they grow up and they do what they're going to do. And you don't have a lot of control over it. And you know, you never really even know. I mean, you can write a song and 20 years later it can be recorded. And so I sort of abandoned the whole set of expectations the effort to sort of push them in any direction, and just, you know, it's hard enough just to write them. That's enough of a job right there.
Yeah. Like I feel like that's just it's kind of doing the whole getting the cart in front of the horse thing, but also yes. Like you can just, it complicates things where you, I don't know, I can see where you go, oh, well, they would never sing this, so I can't necessarily put that in a song. Or,
and the thing is, you don't know that either. I mean, if you're, mm-hmm. if you're, and any artist worth their salt is going to, you know, I mean, the definition of an artist is someone who's constantly moving forward and changing. And, you know, if you're trying to match or aim at a target that was an album that they recorded 2 years ago, you know, they're a moving target. That's not going to work. And, you know, yeah, there are some artists that just want to recreate their hit, you know, and if that's the kind of writing you want to do, good luck, you know. But an artist that's really seeking and searching and trying to grow into their craft and everything, they're you don't know what they're going to be looking for, and you don't know what they will or won't say. I mean, I've been always surprised. I had a song that I loved that I wrote early on that had the two central characters in the song had a baby out of wedlock, and I loved the song. It was a very positive song about their love and their, you know. And I had an artist who shall remain nameless, but was very, very popular at the time, refused to record the song because they had a baby out of wedlock. This particular artist had two babies out of wedlock. So, you know, trying to play that guessing game forget about it. Like I said, it's hard enough to write the songs. Don't try to worry about where they go. But again, I say that through the privilege of having had great publishers through my career.
Yeah. We'll end this on this. Obviously, I feel like 5 minutes into this interview, you mentioned how your vision of being an artist was always to be a singer-songwriter. And that meant mm-hmm. recording your own songs and making records. You know, it was not until 96 that you get out The Secret of Life. What was it like to, you know, obviously, not to transition, but like to put that hat on and be in the recording studio and start recutting your own records?
Well, the recording part of it was blissful. I remember joy. I mean, I've always loved being in the studio, and I had really every demo, every song demo I had made from the time I moved to Nashville to the time I made that record was, in my mind, practice. It was just practice at being in the studio, learning the ropes, learning how to be better. It was all, you know, yes, it was, the purpose was to make the demo of the song, but really for me, what I was doing is pretending to make records or, you know, trying to get as close to the experience of making a record as I could. So I remember the recording part of it in a very positive light. The actual execution, you know, putting that record out and going out and doing what everyone did at the time, which was the brutal radio tour, the 6 weeks of, you know, two and three cities a day. That was really fraught. First of all, I felt very uncomfortable. I remember just an overall feeling of discomfort, because I think at my deepest levels, I knew I was being sold as a country artist. And this was in 1996. So it was a pretty transitional time for country music. There was, you know, Shania Twain was out there, and this whole kind of Steve Earle, Nancy Griffith, Kathy Mattea, the O'Kanes, that era of folky country artists were there. That was kind of coming to a close at that point. And I was firmly in that mold. And I was firmly not in the Shania Twain mold. So it was almost like I could feel that, and I could feel the record company, you know, trying to corral me into this, pour me into this mold that I probably didn't fit in. I mean, they presented me correctly, I guess, but they softened the edges a lot. And I don't know. I just remember feeling a lot of discomfort over that. And mainly during the radio tour, especially, I ran into so much hostility almost, from a lot of radio people. Just, you know, I mean, I remember sitting down with at a radio station many times, and some form of, so you were a hit songwriter for X years, and now you want to be an artist. So what's up with that? You know, that kind of question.
Yeah.
And it was, I mean, first of all, that question to this day offends me, because if you're an artist, you're an artist. You know, if you're an artist when you're 5 years old, you're an artist. It doesn't matter what you've put out or what you've done. It's not, there's not some place you sign up for that. You just are. And so the whole notion of becoming an artist just really, really grated on me. But more than that, I think it was just this sense of, I mean, I remember a guy at a radio station saying to me, so, you made all this money. He just wouldn't stop talking about money. He said, you made all this money writing hits for other people, and now you want to be an artist. What do you want, all the money? And he thought he was being funny, you know? And I just think now, I think, why didn't I slap him? You know? but that was hard. That was really, really, really hard to stomach, a lot of that. And I think that it was, you know, I look back now and I think, you know, it's a damn good thing that my record didn't do better than it did, because I would never have made a right turn or a left turn, really, and gone down the road that I went down, that I'm on now, if it had been more successful. I saw what it was like. I saw what was required of me. I didn't want to do it. I didn't feel comfortable with it. I was, as was the way with many record labels at the time, kind of kept at arm's length from the people that might be my fans. I mean, they wanted artists to maintain this sort of air of mystery and exclusivity, and they don't, you know, aside from fanfare, they don't really mingle, you know. All of that made me just incredibly uncomfortable. So, you know, sometimes I think nowadays, I did not end up with the career that I thought that I wanted, but I ended up with the career that I really wanted, and certainly the one that I should have had. And I'm so grateful for that. So the artistic process of making that first album, it was great. The actual process of going out and promoting it and seeing how it was received or not received, not so great.
Yeah, that seems like it, a lot of, you know, 5 minute small talk conversations that really never go anywhere as far as like the radio promotion and all that kind of stuff, and having to kind of.
Well,
like,
and they, at the time too, everyone did the radio tour. So there was this really revolving door of artists going through. I mean, every 5 minutes you would be in the waiting room to talk to a DJ, and there'd be two other artists from other record labels there with their reps from their labels. And it was like, well, why is this special? I mean, I'm sure the DJs felt that way. I mean, it's not special anymore when every, you know, you've got to actually make time for three artists coming in on the, you know, on the 3 hour morning show, you know, it just sort of lost its meaning. It was just this kind of these hoops that they put you through because everyone else did it. And so, you know, you couldn't get off the merry-go-round. It was sort of, ridiculous and incredibly stressful. And, but mostly I think for me, it was just that I didn't feel seen by those people. I felt like they thought, like that one guy, I was in it for the money, mm-hmm. which makes me laugh. It really makes me laugh. You know, I didn't really feel that I was being seen as who I really was. And that's the bottom line for me. I think that's why I became a writer, so that I could make myself understood. So, you know, I think that's at the heart of every writer. They just want to be understood. They want to be clear about things, you know, and that's why we write, because, you know, we have to make ourselves known.
Yeah. And also, like, I always try and encourage people. And that's why, like, I want a lot of songwriters from this era to come on, because not only clearly you guys had cuts, but a lot of y'all, if you go back through, you can find these incredible records that were made by that obviously flew under the radar, but that are just incredible, you know? So,
absolutely. They're out there. Such great music was made. I mean, just, yeah, you know, we were in the middle of it, so we didn't know what a golden era it was. I talked to my friend Matresa about that all the time. I mean, Matresa and I were just like so lucky to be in the right place at the right time. Obviously we both had something to offer, you know, but I think we, both of us could have been forgiven if we'd thought it was going to go on forever. Like that, and we'd have these wonderful, fantastic voices like Patti Loveless and Trisha Yearwood and Martina McBride to sing our songs, you know. But of course, that was never going to go on forever. But it looking back now, I just think how wonderful to have been in the right place at the right time for that wonderful era of country music.
Okay, that is it for this one. Thank you so much to Gretchen Peters. Thank you for listening. Once again, if you haven't subscribed to the Neon Eon just yet, please hit that subscribe button. All right, next week we kick a little and talk about what might have been with another great from the Neon Eon.